president's been very clear that not taking options off the table gives us a stronger hand.
Anticipating a U.S. response to North Korea. It's Thursday, April 20th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us online right now for VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, Jakarta may have a new mayor. Overtime can kill in Japan. Investing in Cambodia tech startups. Could tropical diseases be of concern to you? Check out these stories and more now on VOA Asia. With concerns mounting over North Korea's quickly advancing nuclear and ballistic missile programs, White House officials are signaling an aggressive new posture toward Pyongyang. But it's not exactly clear what that means, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
A show of force at the border with North Korea. With North Korean soldiers just meters away, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence delivered an in-person warning to the North that U.S. policy is changing.
The era of strategic patience is over.
It was a brief statement with a big implication that the U.S. will no longer wait as North Korean leader Kim Jong-un expands his nuclear and missile programs on display here at a recent military parade. But U.S. President Donald Trump's next step isn't clear. Trump has suggested the U.S. could act alone against the North. To back up that threat, a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group is headed for the Korean Peninsula. Trump has also tried to persuade Chinese leader Xi Jinping to put more economic pressure on his North Korean ally. But those steps are variations of strategies already used by past administrations, raising the question, just how much will U.S. policy change under Trump? Chris Hill, a former U.S. ambassador to South Korea and lead negotiator in nuclear talks with the North, says there's no magic answer.
There's a finite number of things that one can do. And so in diplomacy, I wouldn't expect someone to, you know, pull a rabbit out of a hat that no one expected.
Hill, who spoke via Skype, also questions Trump's strategy of unpredictability. That's a reference to Trump's insistence that he won't telegraph his next move and that all options are on the table.
Unpredictability can be very good if you're, you know, playing football or basketball and the other side doesn't know what you're going to try to do to score. But it can also cause a lot of problems, especially when your partners don't really know you very well and don't really know what your instincts are and don't really have a sense of how you like to do things.
At the White House, Press Secretary Sean Spicer also declared a new era of North Korea policy, but refused to go into details.
So the president's been very clear that not taking options off the table gives us a stronger hand.
Just what Trump will do with that hand is anyone's guess. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
And there's plenty of video with this story to see. Check it out on VOA. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia, and also check out our voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. U.S. strike force delay complicates North Korea policy. Pakistan awaits court verdict that could unseat Sharif. New Zealand tightens immigration rules in a Kiwi-first crackdown. How fundamentalist voices are amplified on Indonesian TV and radio. Disappearing islands fuel climate change fears. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Residents in Jakarta, Indonesia, voted for the city's governor in a runoff election Wednesday. Incumbent Governor Basuki Cahaya Purnama faced off against former Education Minister Anies Baswedan. It's the second such vote for the office after neither candidate captured more than 50% of the ballots cast in the regular February election. Official results are not quite out yet, but various quick counts have Baswedan with about 55 to 60% of the votes, and that was enough for Purnama to concede the election to Baswedan. Reporter Krithika Varagher in Jakarta spoke with VOA Asia's Steve Miller shortly after the polls closed.
Overall, what was the mood during the election? Because there had been some tension with some more conservative elements saying that they wanted to have individuals observe the actual voting today.
That was a lot of bluster, but it was true that the Jakarta police took no chances and deployed 60,000 military and police personnel around the city to make sure no disturbances happened. So, you know, whether or not they had called for that, there would have been quite a lot of security, which you could see everywhere today.
You mentioned back in February that a lot of people heading to the polls had had a very exuberant disposition. Was that mirrored again today?
People are still happy to vote. This is a polarizing election, and polarizing elections, people feel strongly for their candidates. So it's true that everyone I saw seemed, you know, excited to vote. They had a holiday day off. Indonesians, you know, love voting. But there was definitely a tension today since the stakes seemed much higher in a way that it was in February when people kind of assumed it would go on to a runoff. This time, the people I met in neighborhoods like Pasar Ikan and Luar Batang, who were evicted by Ahok, were extremely emotional until it was called.
Now, Basuki Tahaja Purnama, also known as Ahok, is currently on trial for blasphemy, and the proceedings were temporarily suspended because of the election. Do we have an idea what's next for Purnama now that the election is said and done?
Honestly, no one knows. The bigger question would have been what would happen if he were convicted and had won today. That would have been, terra incognita. At this point, the stakes are considerably lower. Many observers think he'll get a more lenient sentence as to not add insult to the injury of losing. And in large part, the crusade against him worked in the sense that he didn't win the election. Yeah, I think people will push less harshly for big conviction now.
Are analysts and observers who have been following the election placing a lot of weight on the trial as to how the election played out?
That's without a doubt. I mean, this blasphemy accusation and the mass demos against him were totally unexpected in their scope and popular sentiment. Of course, there were a bunch of other things bundled into that anti-Ahok sentiment, like his addictions program and his personality. So some of the things made him susceptible to such an attack, even though he's widely regarded as very clean, not corrupt, and effective governor. So once this thing kind of gained traction, it was impossible to underestimate. It took on a life of its own in WhatsApp groups and social media and really just convinced a lot of people not to vote for him. That is evident in the votes.
Reporter Krithika Varagher in Jakarta speaking with VOA Asia's Steve Miller. Happening now in Asia, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence says Washington would work with its allies and China to put economic and diplomatic pressure on North Korea. China's foreign ministry said it was concerned over Pyongyang's statements and is opposed to any actions that raise tensions. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The Japanese government on Wednesday unveiled its first ever attempt to place a limit on how much overtime each month employees can work. It's a bid to tackle what is called karoshi in Japanese, or death from overwork. The country's unforgiving work culture was jolted by the suicide of 24-year-old Matsuri Takahashi in December. He was an employee who worked for Japan's largest advertising agency, Dentsu, who left a note for her mother saying, quote, "Why do things have to be so hard?" Well, it prompted the agency's head to resign. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has vowed to change the way Japan works. His ruling Liberal Democratic Party has called for an employee's overtime to be kept under 100 hours a month and average no more than 80 hours a month over any 2 to 6 month period, with an annual cap of 720 hours. Critics say the plan doesn't go far enough. Michael Kuchek, an adjunct fellow at Temple University in Tokyo, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, official acknowledgement that karoshi exists makes Japan unique, where they are, quote, "working me to death" is more than just an expression.
here, the labor officials and the courts work together in the cases of deaths where it seems that the person who has passed away was indeed forced to work well beyond what anyone would consider normal monthly working hours.
Does the ruling government now put this into place, or does it have to pass a parliamentary approval?
It is a bill, and it does have to pass the Diet, but debate over it is largely symbolic. The Prime Minister's party controls both houses of the Diet by substantial majorities, and there is no possibility of any of the members of the ruling party defecting. However, it is not very good in terms of PR. The number of overtime hours, which was negotiated basically with the largest employers organization, the Keidanren, the number is absurd that in a single month one can have 100 hours of overtime. It is simply a ridiculous number. It's true that it does also have a cap on the annual total, which is 720 hours out of an entire year. Still, that is way beyond what anyone was thinking about. What makes it especially bad optically is that the debate about overtime comes from the suicide of a young woman who worked for the advertising giant Dentsu. And her suicide from just completely stressing out, she was living not at home, but in a corporate dormitory. So there was never anybody to talk to, never anybody way of her breaking out of the environment where you must work, you must work, you must work, was being pressed upon her. She eventually just took her life. And it is her story that has driven the narrative of a need for some kind of control over Japanese corporations so that they cannot simply work their employees to death.
With Japan having struggled to stay competitive despite years of stagnation and little or no growth since 1989, Michael Kuchek says the abuse has grown worse with employers demanding more productivity out of their staff. According to Bloomberg News, overwork was a contributing factor in more than 2,000 suicides in Japan just in the year 2015. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the popularity of the Philippines' drug war has dropped. The 78% program satisfaction rating is down from 85% in December. Two senior law enforcement officials say police received cash for executing drug suspects, planted evidence, and carried out most of the killings. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, VOA Khmer Service reporter Sofat Sung spent several months in California's Silicon Valley and in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, covering that nation's emerging technology sector. Previously on VOA Asia, Sung told VOA's Steve Miller how he prepared for the assignment and how technology startups are only now receiving investments from venture capital groups. Just who are funding these startups? Well, today, they talk about the leading source of outside investments, which stem from a more personal connection.
Cambodia receives a lot of Chinese investment. And so when I was there during the 3 months, it was obvious. And even before that, you know, that Phnom Penh, you could literally say transformed, you know, just over the last 5 years or so. Within the tech sector, however, you don't see that yet. I mean, if you think about who is helping push the tech sector, you know, it's the locals, obviously, but a lot of Cambodian Americans, just because of their connection to the U.S. mm-hmm. and their connection to Cambodia, have been a major part of this. You know, they did STEM Festival and things like that. I have a whole report on them, which is quite unique. You have the Europeans. So the Chinese are not in there in the co-working spaces and whatnot. But you wonder, you know, that there's so much influence there. Would they be interested in you doing more? One thing it struck me was, you know, when I was asking people, so can you buy stuff from Amazon? And I was told no, but you can buy stuff from Alibaba.
From Alibaba. So the Jack Ma version of eBay or Amazon.
So, I mean, it's also another interesting trend. You'll see, you know, how much Chinese influence in the tech scene in Cambodia or Southeast Asia is going to grow or help. I think a lot of the startups or like the bigger tech companies that we talk about have ties to China, because I think that's the more immediate source of talent.
Well, talent, and I think also in terms of possible fabrication as well.
Definitely. Actually, one of the most successful early sort of e-commerce company, who was also running the website that got the Silicon Valley investment. So it's called Little Fashion. They sort of figured out the temporary logistics to make e-commerce work. So basically they sell clothes for young people, especially their target. You know, they imported these clothes from China. So they always had to, you know,
go back and forth.
Yeah, like so a lot of people bring products from China. And so that's obviously a growing business. As e-commerce growth, there's probably going to be more interaction on the
now, front. Now, speaking of e-commerce, you know, one of the things that we have here in the United States and elsewhere around the world is the quote-unquote sharing economy, using apps and so forth. So you think of Uber, Lyft, Grab. Has that made a splash in Cambodia?
Oh, yeah, actually, definitely. When I was there in January, there was this first report of Uber starting to study the Cambodian market. And I actually also did a report on that and talked to the existing app. So that's what was also fascinating.
So what was the existing app?
There are a bunch of different apps. So there's one that it's called Xnet, which is basically Uber. And so that was actually that made a lot of news. So traditionally, you have
big fish eating small fish,
you know, in traditional companies. In the tech world, it's possible that a small fish will eat the big fish, you know? A startup can grow so quickly that it's going to disrupt an entire industry. And I think we've known that from Silicon Valley. What's interesting as a trend is, you know, talked about Uber and Grab and whatnot, is that you have two potentially conflicting trends. One is a big international company like Uber or a regional company like Grab comes into Cambodia and completely destroys the existing ride-sharing apps. Or you can have the opposite is, and that I also saw, smaller Cambodian companies, like the startup that was the website, Khmer Load, that is now growing in Myanmar. They had a pilot in Indonesia, and they got this investment from Silicon Valley, and they could become this Cambodian global company. So you could have...
That's a great story.
It's fascinating, the possibilities in this globalized tech world.
Sung says prior to his returning to the United States from his reporting trip, Uber began a second round of investigations examining Cambodia's digital landscape. He returns for tomorrow's program along with Steve Miller to discuss changes in Cambodia amid some lingering effects of the Khmer Rouge. Developing at this hour in Asia, residents in Jakarta, Indonesia voted for the city's governor. The Jakarta Post Quick Count has former Education Minister Anies Baswedan with 58% of the votes over incumbent Governor Basuki Jahaja Purnama. Purnama is also on trial at the Supreme Court for blasphemy. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, taking turns, taking risks, and following the rules are lessons that people can learn by playing games. One road to those skills is old-fashioned board games, where people sit together and move tiny figurines on a special board. In most board games, only one player wins, and everyone else must accept defeat. But a newer style teaches a different skill. In these games, the deck is stacked against everyone. Players only win if they cooperate. From a game cafe in Berkeley, California, Shelley Schlender reports.
No. Does that mean that we're done? Is that
it? It may be that we're done.
No. They're not done yet. Still, suspense is high at the Victory Point Cafe in Berkeley, California, as these three friends huddle over a colorful board and move thimble-sized figurines. Their goal is to save the world from pestilence and death. If they fail, a pandemic of little disease cubes will pile up on the board, signaling the destruction of all humankind. And in this board game, named Pandemic, Yanni says diseases usually win.
People have created this game to make you lose, so it's a challenge mentally.
As their next mental challenge, Yanni's team must draw from a diabolical deck that's filled with cards that make even more disease cubes pile up. To reduce another disaster, the friends decide to build a little hospital.
Oh, you want me to build?
Either you.
You want me to build it?
Or if you give me two cards, then I guess I can build it, I think.
Every turn, we're all talking about the turn we're taking together.
They draw a card from that dangerous deck.
Oh, so good.
And survive.
That was so lucky.
Yanni says that when he's hanging out with friends, he likes board games.
It's kind of social at the same time. It's not something you do on your own. I used to play a lot of computer games, and that's fun, but it's between you and a computer screen. Even if you're online and playing with other people, it's not. Here you're like literally in person, and you play a game together, whether it's cooperated or competitive. You're socializing in a way, and it's entertaining.
To help with all that socializing, the Victory Point Cafe offers patrons beer, coffee, and board games. Nora, the assistant manager, says those board games are a big part of the appeal.
You know, you can play video games with other people, but you don't look at them necessarily face-to-face over a board that you share pieces on and that sort of thing. You can't hand things to other people. It's just very tactile and very visual, and you know, I feel like it uses more engagement, and people crave that.
The Victory Point Cafe offers a wall full of board games that customers can borrow, and most of these games are competitive. But Nora likes the cooperative games, such as Pandemic.
There's something about cooperative games that I just find really enjoyable and almost comforting because you're working together.
As for what this means in the game of life.
Well, if your life is having to cure a disease before it kills everyone in the world, then yes, I guess it's a metaphor for life.
Yet in a world that needs people solving problems together, Yanni says that playing cooperatively speaks to him.
We have a very good team when we're playing together. And if we didn't have this level of teamwork, we wouldn't have been able to do it. We would have lost the game.
Board game fans say that win, lose, or cooperate, anyone who finds a game they love will have a grand adventure. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Berkeley, California.
To help protect the world against real diseases, governments and private donors have pledged more than $800 million to control or eliminate neglected tropical diseases. The commitment was made at a five-day summit convened to advance efforts to try to overcome disabling diseases of poverty. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA in Geneva, where the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation kicked off proceedings at a special event Tuesday.
In keeping with its commitment to tackle neglected tropical diseases, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is contributing $335 million in grants to support projects over the next 4 years. Neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, affect more than 1.5 billion people in 149 countries, including more than 500 million children. They kill about 170,000 people yearly and cause untold suffering for millions of men, women, and children who are disfigured, disabled, stigmatized, and unable to work their way out of poverty. Leaders from governments, pharmaceutical companies, and charitable organizations gathered at the event hosted by the Gates Foundation to celebrate the achievements of the 2012 London Declaration. That landmark agreement produced a roadmap for the control, elimination, and eradication of 10 of the world's 18 NTDs by 2020. Foundation CEO Bill Gates says the goals have not all been met, but great progress has been made over the past 5 years.
Some of these diseases are on track to be done by 2020, some by 2025, some will take longer than that. But in areas like sleeping sickness, great results, great tools, and just a level of sophistication being put together here. Part of what's enabled it is the unbelievable drug donations.
The World Health Organization says nearly 1 billion people a year have been receiving drugs to prevent one or more NTDs. Sub-Saharan Africa, where more than 40% of these diseases are concentrated, has been a major recipient of donated drugs with great results. For example, WHO notes the development of non-toxic drugs for African sleeping sickness has reduced the number of cases of this deadly disease from 37,000 in 1999 1999 to well under 3,000 cases in 2015. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We thank you for listening to VOA Asia. For Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Jim Harmon, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Enjoy the day.